Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. I'm Katie Givens. I'm still not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
Well, we are back again. It is still cold. Mm-hmm. It is still dreary.
It's not as cold as it was last week, thank goodness.
It's not, but it's just January, and I'm tired of it.
I looked at the weather this morning. The high next Wednesday, 62 degrees.
Okay. That sounds more like you, Alabama weather.
Well, maybe it'll be this Wednesday as you listen.
For us.
No, it's next Wednesday. It's the first Wednesday in February.
February?
February.
Are we pronouncing the second R?
Let's not have that conversation again. Before we got on the air today, we were talking about pronunciation. Mm-hmm. Shane and Katie called me at 10:30 last night because they were having an argument over how a word was pronounced.
Correct.
And we're not going to get into the whole thing, but we got it settled, and I'm happy to report that Shane Givens was wrong.
Yeah,
that's funny.
Yeah,
he kept asking me. He said, "Can you not just say okay sometimes?" And I'm like, "No, I really cannot."
Especially when you're right.
Especially even when I'm wrong, though, I can't. he always accuses me. He says, "When you're wrong, you just change the argument." And I'm like, "But then, am I right? Did I stumble into being right? I don't." If you wanted a yes man, you should have married somebody else.
Yeah, Katie and I finally just wore him down last night. It took a minute, but we finally just banged him over the head with the facts.
I don't think he ever admitted to being wrong. I think he was just tired of us yelling at him.
He did not concede, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. He did not go quiet.
All right, that's all right. Stand strong, then.
You guys know that we have some awesome shows coming up at Easy Street in the weeks ahead.
Yes.
On February the 7th, that is a Friday, the 80s rock band, the M80s.
They are very good.
Wow. That show's going to start probably at 9 o'clock. And then the following Friday night is February the 14th. That's Valentine's Day. And that is the second Motown show with Shane and Charlie and Jeannie and Skip and the whole band.
Yep. Oh. But now, if they're Friday night shows, they may start at 8:30. So
Double check. All you have to do to find out is go to easystreet.ticketleap.com. And both of those shows are listed on the page. And then you can find out which show you'd like to do, what time it starts. The tickets are $15 a piece. So come and hang out with us.
Just come early and eat dinner. And then you'll be here when the show starts.
Yeah, you'll have a seat. You won't have to fight anybody over it.
Right.
Because this past weekend, a band called Pop Fiction played.
Yeah.
They were so good. They were like all your radio hits from like the last, honestly, probably like 20 years now. God, that sounds crazy.
Wow.
But they're playing
Matchbox 20.
Imagine Dragons.
Oh, I love
it. Was.
Wish I'd come.
It was so good. Like I was, I'd seen some videos of them, of course, but I hadn't heard them. They're from like Jackson, Mississippi. So they had, they traveled 5 hours to come play. And
love a good band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
Speaking of eating. Mm-hmm. Eat dinner, of course, at Easy Street when you come and see us.
Yeah.
But a couple of weeks ago when Kelly was not here, we had a brief discussion about the Waffle House. That was our Alabama Lottery Lady show.
Yeah.
And we talked about some foods, and I told my favorite meal. And the dessert that I like is pecan pie warmed on the grill with a pat of butter on top. And we had a discussion about what that would be called when the waitress turns in the order. So a couple of days later, Will Bailey, friend of the show, is listening to that episode, and he texts me out of the blue one morning, and he says, "That is called dressed." And then he texted me right back immediately and said, "I'm 65% sure about that." What a random number to have, Will. So I Googled it and looked it up, and actually what it is called is heated and treated.
Heated and treated, yes. Yeah. That is what it is. I was like, dressed does not sound right. Heated and treated is what I was
so
thinking.
So a swing and a miss from our good friend Will Bailey, but we didn't know either, so thanks for trying, Will.
Right.
At least you got the bat off your shelf, off your shoulder. I didn't even swing at it. I just guessed.
Watched that answer just scratched my brain. Like, I have been... thinking of that. Oh,
hated and treated. I love that Waffle House has its own language.
So we talked about our favorite meals. Kelly, why don't you tell us your favorite meal from Waffle House? And while you're thinking about it, mine was a BLT with Burt's chili and then the pecan pie. And according to Shane, Katie's is, she grabs the menu, points to the breakfast side and says, "Yes, please."
I like a 2-egg breakfast scrambled with cheese with Raisin toast and grits. And he says, "I get a waffle."
See, that's everything.
I usually don't get the waffle and that because that's the all-star. Mm-hmm. And that's everything. And I usually pick one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time I go the sensible way and try to do an egg with some dry toast. But what I really want deep down in my soul, what I really want is a pecan waffle.
Yeah. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's okay. The one. That's my favorite.
Well, I felt like I needed to explain that because you wouldn't have known what we were talking about.
I listened.
You did listen to that episode? Okay.
I did. So all I knew what you were talking
about. Well, then you were ready with your
But I didn't
menus.
Know what that was called when you put the pie. I didn't know you could ask them to put pie on the
mm-hmm. I never knew what it was called. And that's my favorite
thing. That's next level.
Yeah, I know.
I do have a shout out.
No, I'm just filling in time. Go ahead.
Okay. I do have a shout out.
All right, let's hear it.
So Riley Shaw.
Okay.
Who is a friend of the show.
R-Y-L-E-E.
And
R-I-L-E-E.
She I was visiting her and getting coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me that she's taking some paralegal classes.
All right.
And they are currently talking about the Judith Ann Neely case.
Ooh,
and she was one of the few in the class, maybe the only one that actually had heard of the case.
Knew her shit thanks to us.
Exactly. And the teacher said, you know, how are you familiar with this? She said, that podcast I told you I listened to all the time.
All right.
So thank you, Riley. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Riley. Appreciate
if we had any free items to give out, we can't find the t-shirts, but if we had any Riley with two E's, we would give it to you.
Correct.
Thanks for the plug.
Correct.
I was going to say that there is a new documentary series that just dropped this past week on Netflix about the O.J. Simpson case.
Okay.
And it's because this is the 30th anniversary of the trial. The murders took place in 94. The trial was 95. And we did that series, or we did that show a couple of years back. We kind of approached it from a different angle, but I'm curious to see this Netflix special about the O.J. Simpson case. But if you want to freshen up on that before you watch it, that would be season 2, episode 24.
I can go ahead and tell you that I'm not going to be tuning into that. Not because, I mean, if that's your thing, that's your thing. But I'm ready for O.J. to just be dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible, but I'm just, let's not beat the dead horse. Let it just be dead.
One last shout out, sort of, to Jimmy Givens.
Jimmy.
That's Katie's father-in-law, and of course, Shane's dad, who is probably working just as hard in his retirement as he ever did in
no
his
doubt.
Career.
Yeah.
Along with Aiden and the rest of the kitchen staff. They do a great job with the daily lunch specials, the soups, the sandwiches, the chili, the spaghetti, the barbecue, all the rest.
It's all good.
And Jimmy does a wonderful job on the Easy Street Facebook page every day of updating the special. He's got a little motivational message in there for you, and he begins every one of them with, Jimmy here.
Yep.
So you know who's really in charge in the kitchen at Easy Street and the whole operation, really.
That's right. That's
but yeah, shout out to Jimmy. They do a great job. If you don't eat lunch at Easy Street, you're missing out.
That's true. Definitely.
That's all I have.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for tuning in.
See y'all next week.
Okay. So this week, Scott's in the big chair.
So be nervous.
In the big chair.
Yeah, Katie, you better be nervous. I'm going to pick on you a little bit today, but it's all in fun.
Okay.
We'll see.
So what are we talking about today? Let's assume no one read the title of today's episode. What are we discussing?
We're talking about the Tylenol murders.
Okay.
And they took place in 1982.
Okay. And this one is not as widely known as some of the other things that we've done. I've listened to podcasts who've covered this, but I'm always shocked at people who don't know that this was a thing.
I don't really know the story. I know bits and pieces from hearing y'all talk about it, but I didn't dive into it because I wanted to learn.
I think people of a certain age remember when it was on the news, excuse me, every night, because I was 12 years old in 82 and I remember I remember that being something that led the evening news for weeks.
It is a terrifying concept. Yeah. It's going to make you look at things differently when you walk into your local store and purchase some sort of over-the-counter medication.
That's right.
Or really over-the-counter anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be scary today, just saying. So.
Somebody fill in. I've got a tickle in my throat. Sorry.
I'm not the biggest fan of just taking a lot of over-the-counter medicine. And then, like, in my house, ibuprofen's the thing. Mm. Like, Shane will pop ibuprofen, like, it's candy. And he'd be like, I'd be like, oh, my head hurts. Have you taken any ibuprofen? I'll be like, no, I'm just kind of always have a headache, you know? I think that's a part of being a woman, you know? Like, daily, it's at some point, something is going to hurt at some point.
I know. I currently have one right now, but I think it's because my headphones are backwards. I'm going to fix those.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
My headache always starts in my eyes, and I don't have, like, eyesight problems, so I don't know if it's the computer or the weather. You know, you just...
Yeah. I'm pretty lucky. I very seldom, if ever, have a headache. I mean, I go months at a time without even a twitch. But my mom used to have migraines when I was a kid. So I remember the lights out, curtains drawn.
Terrible.
Don't make any noise upstairs because I can't stand it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I did flip my headphones around. Yeah, now I'm going to take my earrings
out. Are you sure they're in the right direction?
No, I have to put them in the opposite direction and then they fit correctly. Whatever. So whatever.
So
my head's on backwards or my ears.
That certainly explains a lot.
I'm gonna say go ahead.
Okay.
Keep talking. I'm going to take out my earrings as we speak. Go ahead.
I'll take it for a minute. So before we start today's show, like I do a lot of times, I'm going to set the table. The year was 1982, but I wanted to do it a little bit differently today. Mm-hmm. Instead of just running down the calendar from January to December, like I usually do when I set the table, I thought I would take it category by category. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start with technology news from 1982. The first ever computer virus began infecting Apple II computers in 1982. That virus had to be delivered in the day before the internet by a floppy disk.
Okay, I was just wondering.
Katie, we will show you a picture of one of those.
I remember a floppy disk from like kindergarten.
And the virus was created by a bored and ostracized 15-year-old computer nerd, setting the standard for decades in the way that computer viruses were created to begin with.
Wow. He was bored.
And obviously smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sony introduced the first CD player in October of 1982. Now, the CD had premiered a couple of months earlier in Germany, but this was the first publicly available CD player. And at the time, a CD would only contain 74 minutes of audio information, which made it perfect for albums at the time. Mm-hmm. It would be a couple of years before it would be the technology would allow a lot more information to be stored on a CD so that computer programs could be. And then AOL happened and they ran out of CDs because everybody got 5 in the mail every week.
Still a wild concept to
me. I know. In December of 1982, for the first time, Time Magazine named its person of the year the computer. So it wasn't even a person. They've done worse.
They really have.
In entertainment news from 1982, Johnny Carson hosted the Oscars in 1982, and the big winner in March was Chariots of Fire, which Katie has seen, right, Katie?
No.
Add it to the list. The Weather Channel premiered in April of 1982 on TV. The Steven Spielberg film E.T., we've discussed that before, Katie?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thumbs up on that one. I've seen E.T. June of 82, it was the biggest hit ever at the movies, and it would be for the next 11 years until it was eclipsed by another Steven Spielberg film in 1993. Anybody want to take a guess? That's not it.
Jurassic Park.
Well, this another Spielberg film, like I said, and it took over until probably, you know what? I don't know what was next after that. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Maybe, we'll just keep going.
was that the Jeff Goldblum Jurassic
That's right.
Park?
He was in the first two.
He was in the first two. Okay.
But that was the first one with mm-hmm. Sam Neill. And I remember seeing that at the theater in 93. And it changed movies forever because for the first time, dinosaurs looked real.
It was fun to
see on the movie screen.
Yeah.
It wasn't stop motion animation or just stick figures. It looked real.
Yep.
And you can go back and watch it now and it's not quite.
Well, it doesn't
hold up. You can see how much the technology has progressed.
Right, right.
But it was amazing at the time.
Right.
In July of 1982, there was an incident involving actor Vic Morrow, two young children, and a helicopter.
Oh.
On the set of the Twilight Zone movie. We covered that last year, season 4, episode 43. Mm. That was July of 82. And then in November of 82, Michael Jackson released an album. You guys might have heard of it. Thriller.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Today remains the best-selling album in the history of music. Over 120 million copies worldwide.
That's pretty amazing.
Speaking of the world, worldwide events in 1982. You guys remember when the Falklands War happened down in the South Pacific? Argentina and the United Kingdom went to war over these little islands out in the middle of nowhere. I remember that being in the news the entire summer from April until June. It was in the news every night until other things happened. Finally, the British won that, but the Argentines still say it's theirs.
Mm. Is it?
Britain says it's not.
So it's apparently still a disagreement.
agreed to disagree.
Oh.
They got tired of shooting at each other.
Okay.
The World's Fair was held in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1982. And damn it, I wanted to go and Mom and Dad wouldn't take me.
Why
it's not? Only 4 hours away. I don't know. I don't know. My mom had been to the 64 World's Fair in New York City. Maybe she had a bad experience. I don't remember the conversation. I just remember that I didn't get to go and I really
darn
wanted
it.
To. So 11 million other people got to go while it was there for 6 months.
That she had 11 million reasons not to go.
I know why I wouldn't go today.
Exactly. I get it.
True Crime Tales from 1982. In January of that year, the trial of Wayne Williams began in Atlanta.
Okay.
The Atlanta child killer.
Mm-hmm. We did
that
one.
Season 2, episodes 25 and 26. He's still in jail today at age 66.
And that's not that old. Still pretty controversial, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he was only convicted of 2 of the murders, remember?
Yeah. But he did do 2 of the murders.
The other 28.
For sure
question
did
mark.
2, correct?
Well, it was circumstantial evidence, but it was DNA type, you know, carpet fibers, not DNA. There was no DNA.
Yeah.
In
oh, yeah.
It's the fibers. But carpet fibers is what got him.
Yeah.
In March of 1982, the British lawyer and socialite Klaus von Bülow.
Wow, what a name.
Was found guilty by a Rhode Island jury of trying to kill his ex-wife.
Ooh.
And he was sentenced to 30 years in prison, but he never served a day of that sentence. And if you want to find out how that happened, there is a movie from 1990 that stars Jeremy Irons, Glenn Close, and Ron Silver. It is titled Reversal of Fortune. It should be titled Reversal of Good. Because it is not. But if you want to know the story, it will tell
you.
Why
didn't he do any time?
Because Ron Silver plays Alan Dershowitz in the film, and Alan Dershowitz
takes
over.
Familiar.
Yeah, the famous lawyer. We've all heard of Alan Dershowitz.
Mm-hmm.
He took over the appeal and got him off. It got him acquitted. And that is the story that this movie tells. Mm-hmm. Not very well, in my opinion. It's just, it's a 90s movie. It's just not good anymore.
Did he kill his ex-wife?
I don't think so.
It was just an attempted murder case.
Yeah, he
tried to.
He injected her. He allegedly injected her with deadly amounts of insulin. Mm-hmm. And she had other issues. She was addicted to pills. She was an alcoholic. But she was the rich person in the duo. And
motive.
And he was the beneficiary in the will.
Motive.
So.
How rich was she?
$14, $15 million in the 80s. So, enough that they had butlers and a big nice house.
Lots.
And I feel like the movie got certain aspects of their lives correct.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeremy Irons does a great job playing an asshole with a British accent.
Oh,
I mean,
he's
made a career out of that. And he's good at it.
Okay.
Anyway.
Maybe we should do that case.
I think
at
we
some
should.
Point.
I think it would be a good one.
Okay.
And there's a lot of legal stuff to it. So maybe Katie might want to tackle it. I don't know. There's just, it's a big, the appeal is the story, I think. Well, at least that was the focus of the film.
I think we already gave that away, but we could go back. If we wait long enough, people will forget.
Yeah. Forget what?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. On Pearl Harbor Day of 1982, the first execution by lethal injection in American history took place in Texas. The guy's name was Charlie Brooks. He had kidnapped and murdered a man. And the most interesting part, I think, is that he was on death row for 3 years. And that's it.
Of course. I mean,
Texas hustled him right on out the door.
He's lucky he didn't get hanged before then.
Exactly. But of course, the biggest true crime story of 1982, at least as far as we're concerned here today, was the Chicago Tylenol murders.
I believe so.
And so now with the table being filled to overflowing, let's get this story started. We're in the Chicago area. Only 4 years, remember, after the killer clown himself, John Wayne Gacy, was arrested just a few miles away from our crime story today. He was arrested in Norwood Park Township, arrested and sentenced ultimately to killing 33 men.
Oh my gosh.
He died by lethal injection in 94, I think. Mm-hmm. But we've told that story. That's January of 23, episodes 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
But 7 murders is still 7 too many.
Yeah.
As we will learn today, at least John Wayne Gacy got what he deserved for what he did, because officially, 43 years later, the Tylenol murders remains unsolved. So we still don't officially know who committed them. And for a more detailed answer about what happened, you'll just have to keep listening. Katie is already rolling her eyes. She hates it when I do that. All right, so we've browbeaten our listeners to death with the knowledge that this takes place in 1982.
It did. Yeah, it does.
So thanks for the vote of confidence.
You're welcome.
Kelly fucking Turner. Okay, so let's focus in on the month and the day of 1982. September the 29th, 1982. It was a Wednesday morning. In Elk Grove Village, a suburb of Chicago. Just a 15-minute drive from John Wayne Gacy's house. I Google mapped it.
Ugh, wow.
Today's story begins with 12-year-old Mary Kellerman waking up with a sore throat and a runny nose. But 12-year-old Mary's symptoms were about to take a terrible turn for the worse. And we will tell you that story right after these words from our sponsors.
Hey, True Crime fans, it's time to start planning your 2025 summer vacation. And why not take it right here in Cherokee County, Alabama?
We have a ton of things to do here in Cherokee County. You can wet a hook in Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, take in the breathtaking views at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the National Preserve at Little River Canyon, enjoy an all-day splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of lodgings, RV sites, kayak rentals, and campgrounds, and they're all anxious to meet your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come stay with us this summer from wherever you are. Plan your Northeast Alabama summer staycation by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Are you looking for a health option in Cherokee County where the staff makes you feel like family? Then look no further than Cherokee Family Healthcare.
At Cherokee Family Healthcare, they place a huge emphasis on personalized care. Call 256-266-1021 to schedule an appointment, or you can just walk right into the office at 819 West Main Street in Center. If you aren't feeling well, let them help you return to good health.
Connie Geimer and the staff at Cherokee Family Healthcare are currently accepting new patients. They accept most insurance plans. So whatever you're suffering from, if it's a cold, flu, aches and pains, you want to lose some weight or have some preventative testing, you can make an appointment today by calling Connie Geimer and the staff there at Cherokee Family Healthcare. That number is 256-266-1021 and let them get you on your way back to good health.
Katie and Kelly, let me tell you guys a quick story. Recently, I was dining at Easy Street, and I met a man who told me that he and his wife were planning to retire soon to the Weiss Lake area from out of state. I told him that the best person for him to call to help him find a home in the area is Greg Oliver. Greg is the owner and broker at Go Realty. And if you're like the man that I met who is thinking of moving here, or if you're looking for property or a home anywhere in Northeast Alabama or Northwest Georgia, you should call Greg Oliver at 256-504-3847. Greg has a full list of waterfront, residential, commercial, farm, and investment properties, and he is ready to help you find exactly what you're looking for. Greg has 25 years of experience in the real estate market, and you can see a complete list of his current properties by visiting gregoliverweisslake.com. So visit the website or call Greg at Go Realty today. The number is 256-504-3847.
Thank you. All of our wonderful sponsors. Okay, Scott, so now what?
Okay, so 12-year-old Mary Kellerman. Mm-hmm. Mom and Dad kept Mary home from school that day, September the 29th, 1982, and told her to go lie down in the bed and then handed her an extra strength Tylenol capsule from the bottle they retrieved out of their medicine cabinet. They had purchased it a few days before at a local store. Within just a few minutes, Mary was dead on the kitchen floor.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry, the bathroom floor.
Ugh.
Found by her father. The dad said that whatever it was that he saw in that room will live with him for the rest of his life. He would not let his wife go into the room.
Oh my gosh.
Within a week, little Mary's initially unexplained death would become a cause for panic for everybody in the country. And within just a few months, it would forever change the way Americans purchased and consumed over-the-counter medications. Because that capsule that Mary had swallowed was not filled with powdered acetaminophen. It was filled with potassium cyanide.
Oh my gosh.
Which is not good for you.
No. What a horrible death.
Yeah. So what is potassium cyanide? Well, it is chemical compound KCN. And don't ask me for any more than that. I was never good at chemistry. It is colorless, about the consistency of salt or sugar, and it is soluble in water. Among the legitimate and practical uses for potassium cyanide, gold mining, electroplating, and the gilding and buffing of some types of jewelry. It is highly toxic, and a dose of as little as 200 milligrams will kill just about any man, woman, or child. That's a dollop of powder about the size of a black-eyed pea, since we're in the South. Mm-hmm. Or an English pea, if that's your mm-hmm. legume of choice.
Well, think about your 200 milligram ibuprofen,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Katie. That's yeah. it's a small mm-hmm. amount.
Symptoms of acute cyanide poisoning include coma, seizures, apnea, cardiac arrest, mm-hmm. followed by death within seconds. As late comedian George Carlin once said about this case, fuck it, I'd rather have a headache.
No doubt at this point.
Potassium cyanide is often described as having an odor that is smells like bitter almonds.
Mm.
And the taste of potassium cyanide has been described, not by very many people, I suspect,
right,
as having a burning sensation that is acrid and bitter.
Ugh.
Not long after the ambulance and police cruisers pulled away from the Kellerman home in Elk Grove Village, a few miles away in Arlington Heights, and the proximity of these cases will become pertinent to the story as we go.
Sure.
A few miles away, a 27-year-old postal worker named Adam Janice suddenly became very ill and was transported to a local hospital, where a short time later he died of what was initially diagnosed as a massive heart attack. His family members were, of course, distraught over the sudden loss of a seemingly healthy 27-year-old young man. And so they went over to Adam's house that afternoon to console his wife. Adam's brother Stanley and Teresa, his wife, tried to soften the sharpness of their splitting headaches by taking a Tylenol capsule from the same bottle that Adam had used earlier.
Oh, no.
Within minutes, both Stanley, age 25, and his wife, Teresa, age 19, dropped to the floor and were soon thereafter pronounced dead by medical personnel. So far, four victims and counting.
Mm-hmm. And what amount of time are we looking at? This is on the same day. I mean, just...
It was ultimately this event. This would have gone on for days and days and days.
But
three young people dying all the same at once, that's what got the wheels of...
Because it's weird anyway that turning. The first guy would be diagnosed with a heart attack yeah. because he's young.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
He's, mm-hmm. what'd you say?
Well, it's this 27.
27.
Same kind of symptoms. Just sudden, boom, drop dead. Mm-hmm. It that's what you think first. Mm-hmm. Oh, he had a heart defect.
It's got to be.
Some kind.
It's terribly painful. It's got to be terribly painful.
I don't
painful.
Know if it's, for the seconds that it lasts, I'm sure it is, but it's pretty.
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the... If you have to find a silver lining, yeah. it's that it is quick.
Yeah. If you're looking for the lemonade.
Oh, gosh.
One of the very first people to put together the puzzle about the possibility of poisoning was one of the nurses at the hospital where all three of the Janices had been presented that day.
Mm-hmm.
When the nurse visited Adam's house at the request of a fireman, he called this woman he knew who wasn't her, said, "Hey, can you come over and see if you can figure out what the hell's going on over here?"
Sure.
She noticed that there were six capsules missing from the bottle of extra strength Tylenol. Unfortunately, that information didn't get passed out quickly enough to prevent the deaths of three other people.
Oh, my.
Little Mary and the three members of the Janice family were soon followed by in other Chicago suburbs. 31-year-old Mary McFarland. 27-year-old Mary Lynn Reiner, who had just returned home from the hospital from delivering her fourth child.
Oh.
And 35-year-old Paula Prince. Paula was the last of the victims, and she was an airline stewardess. Her body was not found for 2 days because her friends thought that she had flown to Vegas and back.
Mm. Oh, no.
But she never made it to the airport that morning because the night before she had taken a Tylenol capsule and collapsed and died in her closet.
So was she... the first victim, technically,
she was the last
later victim. That day. Okay,
yeah, she wasn't found for several days,
mm-hmm, but she okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Earlier that night, Paula had called her friend to tell her that she had exciting news. She had just become engaged.
Mm.
She never got to tell anybody that story, and it was her friend that she had left that message with who found her 2 days later.
Found her.
In her room.
Oh. Not the fiance?
I don't know. Maybe he was out of town.
Maybe. I bet he was a person of interest.
Possibly. Or maybe it became pretty clear that she was another victim.
Yeah,
but she was found later in the process.
Okay, maybe. So maybe. Yeah,
maybe yeah. not. So we've got seven people dead, all of whom would soon be discovered, as we know, had taken extra strength Tylenol capsules shortly before their deaths. Phew. And all were from the same general suburban Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
As we have been reminding you all along. Maybe too much. Sorry.
No. This is creepy.
Yeah, so by early October, remember that was September the 29th, by early October, investigators had made the connection between the poisoning deaths and the Tylenol capsules, which at the time was the best-selling non-prescription pain medication in the United States. Mm. The gelatin-coated capsules were especially popular because they were slick, easy mm-hmm. to swallow.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, each of the seven victims had swallowed a Tylenol capsule laced with deadly potassium cyanide. McNeil Consumer Products, which was a subsidiary of pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson, mm-hmm. was the manufacturer of Tylenol in several plants around the country, mm-hmm. around the world. To its credit, the companies took an immediate active role with the media. They issued warnings nationwide. They quickly recalled 31 million bottles of Tylenol capsules, mm-hmm. which was worth $100 million in 1982. That's about $330 million today.
So
a third of $1 billion.
So here's what I love about this. They're not trying to keep it quiet.
No.
Or sweep it under the rug.
No.
They are coming out full force going, stop.
Yeah.
Basically, don't purchase our product.
That's right.
Now,
that's what they said.
We've got to figure out what's going on yep. here. And that's commendable.
Yeah.
Do you think yeah. that would happen today in today's
world?
I can't
imagine.
What big corporate giant that we could think of would do that today?
Mm.
You would hope to think that they would.
You would hope to.
But that much money?
We just don't see it. What mm-hmm. I mean, we do get things recalled. I mean, yeah. occasionally
well,
there's like
the
romaine
FDA.
Lettuce. Don't. But that's not from the romaine lettuce people. It's
right.
from
the FDA.
FDA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
As the investigation ramped up, tainted capsules were discovered in several other bottles that had not been obviously taken yet.
Mm.
Or it would have been dead bodies discovered mm-hmm. instead of little tiny red and white capsules that had been tampered with.
Where were they found?
In the same area.
In
the Chicago
same,
area.
Just in that area.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So who is the target? What's going on here? Is it somebody
Everybody?
Who just wanted to randomly kill people? Was it somebody who's mad at Johnson & Johnson? Was it some combination of all of that?
Mm.
Was it some deranged psychopath? That was the question that the local authorities... And then Paula Prince was the last of the victims. She was the first victim who lived inside the city limits of Chicago. The Chicago Police Department had not been involved until that happened. Mm. And it was a different police jurisdiction every time. So there wasn't really a coordinated effort... Mm-hmm. to investigate this until Paula Prince died. Then the Chicago PD, who has investigative teams and forensics and the things yeah. the other smaller departments don't, they got involved.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty quickly, the FBI also got involved.
I was about to say, when does the FBI
yeah.
come
Oh,
in?
Yeah. So I'm thinking this person who is doing this is maybe one of two different things.
They don't know that yet. Keep
no,
in mind.
No, but I'm just thinking, in my head, I'm thinking
okay.
this would be someone like our first... computer virus guy, someone
yeah.
who's just extremely bored,
mm-hmm. extremely smart,
and extremely smart,
yeah.
and just doesn't give a crap, or some really radical person with a manifesto, you know, that's out mad about something in general, so they're just going to burn it down.
Stick a pin in that.
Okay.
Like
all right.
the United Healthcare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
CEO.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've got to answer the question, did it happen at the factory? Did it happen at the warehouse?
Mm.
Did it happen at one of the distribution centers? Or did it happen inside the store?
Mm.
They've got a lot of leads to track down.
What a nightmare.
Now, every bottle of Tylenol had a batch number on it, so it was easy to track it back to where it was created.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a chain all the way
okay.
to the store shelf. From
all
the
right.
manufacturing... from the assembly line to the store shelf, there's a chain of
So it was only a
possession.
Certain batch number that they found.
Initially, it was one batch number, but then another batch number became involved, too, and that set off a panic because
oh.
one of the factories was in Pennsylvania. The other was in Texas.
Oh,
but again, we're in the same area in Chicago.
But that's where they're being
so
shipped.
It's starting to the facts
store.
Are starting to point towards
in the
it
stores.
Wasn't in the supply chain,
mm-hmm. which is actually good news.
That is good news.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if it's something that got contaminated,
ugh.
It could be millions. Mm-hmm. If it got Lord. Contaminated in the manufacturing process,
mm-hmm.
holy shit, we've got a real problem.
Can
we could kill thousands of people.
Can you imagine the CEOs of these companies just like drinking Pepto-Bismol,
oh, yeah.
trying to
for 3 days, for 3 days, a team of about 30 people did not leave corporate headquarters. They showered in the CEO's office and had food brought in because were constantly trying to manage this crisis.
Oh, this is probably one of the first huge crisis management opportunities like in corporate America, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like,
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way
this is where they eventually wrote the book on how to handle
the way they handle this. Yeah. Case is taught in business schools all over the country.
It is, yeah.
It absolutely is. So the initial evidence, like we've said, pointed to somebody taking the bottles off the shelf,
mm-hmm.
taking them home,
hmm.
tampering with them, and returning them to the store and putting them back on the shelf. That's okay. where we're starting to focus our attention.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But the makers of Tylenol still had a business to run and profits to make and stockholders to satisfy. So McNeil and Johnson & Johnson offered replacement capsules, replacement pills for those who turned in the capsules
mm-hmm.
across the country. They offered a reward for any information. And they started the process of trying to figure out how to keep it from happening again. And I'm going to tell you some more details later, but they're trying to do the right thing.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, the people who make Advil are like, come on over.
That is exactly
we gotcha.
What happened. Immediately, the other manufacturers started doing promotions, knocking prices off, putting them in the Sunday supplements mm-hmm. and the coupon pages to try and take over the shelf space
mm-hmm.
in all these stores across the country that was suddenly vacant.
Yeah.
Because Tylenol was no longer on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a mad
And it
effort.
Was number one, so...
Number one.
Here's your chance
yep.
to...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And as I've said earlier, the murderers, whatever, never been found. But there is at least one very suspicious person. We're going to discuss him shortly.
Mm.
But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's get back to October of 1982.
All right.
MASH, Dallas, Magnum P.I. were the big TV shows.
Oh, Magnum P.I. Oh. I used to love to watch.
I know.
Magnum reruns.
I thought I was going to be that guy flying around in a helicopter solving murders when I was an adult, but it didn't work out.
He had the best shirts and the best mustache.
Yeah, he did.
he still has a great mustache.
The
by
big
the way.
Movie, he still does have a great mustache. Tom
sorry,
Selleck.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Go ahead.
The biggest movie, one of the biggest movies of '82, was Rocky III, which had premiered on Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet Katie's never seen that film either.
Was that with Mr. T?
That was the one with Mr. T.
Okay.
So Katie has not
have you seen any of the Rockies?
But,
I've seen bits and pieces of some of them. I've seen like the stair scene.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Katie mm-hmm. does know the theme song from Rocky III, whether she realizes it or not, because that was a brand new song performed by a band named Survivor.
Nice.
The name of the song is Eye of the Tiger.
Mm-hmm. I was about to guess, is it Eye of the Tiger?
Yeah. Yep. And mm-hmm. Katie Beth and I are both former Cedar Bluff Tigers.
Mm-hmm.
So we've both heard that song a million times.
Well,
every time the football team scores a touchdown, the first 25 seconds of Survivor comes over the speaker at LD Bruce Field.
I went to Auburn University. I know a little something about that
song.
Yeah,
there you go. I didn't even think about that. Well, we used it before you guys did.
Really?
Well, maybe
did
we all used it at the same time because it came out in 82. I came along just in time. I didn't realize that song hadn't been around forever. You know, when you hear a song at school, you just think, oh, that's been around forever. It was almost brand new.
I bet most people think that song's actually in the first Rocky and not the third one.
That's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You just think of it when you,
mm-hmm. when
you think
of
Rocky.
Yeah.
Unless you're a Cedar Bluff Tiger.
Yeah. Or an Auburn Tiger.
Go Big Red. Anyway, but we digress. Meanwhile, back in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
the case continued to confuse law enforcement, the drug maker, and the public at large. Johnson & Johnson quickly figured out that the introduction of the potassium cyanide had occurred after the cases of Tylenol had left the factory. And also, there were two factories, like I said, one Texas, one Pennsylvania. They're 1,600 miles apart. So it's unlikely that some random contamination took place in two different facilities.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a time in 1982 in the fall when police cruisers in these neighborhoods in Chicago were driving around slowly in the neighborhoods, screaming into their PA systems, do not take Tylenol until further notice.
Oh, wow.
When the story broke, it was on the front page of every newspaper in the country, as you can imagine. And for the first time since the Atlanta child murders, 24-hour network news network CNN had something that they could talk about for 24 hours straight, and they did for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know now, it turns out they could have talked for 43 years straight, and they still would not have helped to solve the Tylenol murders, at least not officially. Because so far, there's no getting to the bottom of this story. It has no bottom.
That's crazy.
This is like digging on Oak Island. There is no bottom.
Mm.
The mayor of Chicago distributed 1 million leaflets encouraging the people of the Chicago area to hand out money or small toys instead of candy to children on Halloween. The fear was that the next thing was going to happen would be contaminated candy. In fact, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune wrote that any parent who let his child go trick-or-treating that year lacked common sense.
Haven't we talked about the lace candy thing before?
It's never really happened.
I went through
just a story. It's an old wives' tale.
In October, I went through a few things where that happened. But a guy ended up poisoning his own kid.
His own kid, right. Yeah.
And that was the only one, right?
Yeah.
The only documented
case. And a neighbor
case.
Kid, just because the neighbor kid ate the candy.
And there was one neighbor kid that didn't eat it, so.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
He ended up.
Well, as a result of all of this panic about Halloween, trick-or-treating was basically canceled in Chicago in 1982 and in a lot of other places around the country.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why we jumped to candy, but I guess because that would be so easy.
If you want to randomly harm a mass amount of people for no logical reason, that's an easy way to do it. And candy at the time was just about as well protected as over-the-counter medication, which was basically not at all.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and then once it's in someone's home.
Yeah. Kelly, what is the term that you use in your field to describe someone who has a personality disorder that lacks compunction, empathy, or remorse and is also compulsive, manipulative, and deceitful?
Well, that used to be called antisocial personality disorder. So we'll just keep calling it that.
I'm going to keep calling it psychopath. If that's okay, because that's what's in my notes.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say.
Psychopath, sociopath, antisocial personality.
I like psychopath. It's easier to say.
You can, sure. Go ahead.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, much like 4 years earlier, with John Wayne Gacy, there was once again a psychopath, my term, running loose in the Chicago area.
I'll accept that.
Today we call them Chicago Bears fans.
Oh, God. No, we don't.
Sorry.
It's fine. Scott's
that was low hanging fruit. I admit it.
I know.
And full disclosure, I was a big fan of the Super Bowl Shuffle music video in 1985, but I did root for the Patriots in that game, which Chicago won handily. One of the most lopsided Super Bowls in history. They beat the hell out of the upstart Patriots.
Was that Ditka? Was he there?
That was Ditka. Mm-hmm. He was the head coach of the Bears. Yeah, and Jim McMahon and Walter Payton and Refrigerator Perry.
Talk about a
new documentary.
Fantastic mustache.
Yeah.
Mike Ditka.
Yeah. No? I've seen that mustache in person. Your husband has too. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's amazing how the mustache has made the comeback.
It really has. And not everybody can do it. So let's just stop this madness.
I can't do it.
Okay.
I wish I could.
If your mustache doesn't look like Tom Selleck's or Mike Ditka's,
Shave it. Get rid of it. Yeah, let it go.
Otherwise,
you Colin Givens.
Otherwise, you look like you should drive around.
Never gonna hear this.
Yeah, shout
down. You look like you should drive around in a white van and entice children.
It says free candy on the side.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
All right, that's it. Let's get back to the Tylenol murders. Now, there were other copycat poisonings involving Tylenol and other over-the-counter medications in the 80s and 90s. But those events were never as dramatic or as deadly as the Chicago area incident that is our focus today. And if you want to peruse a plethora of conspiracy theories about the motives and suspects for both the Chicago killings and the follow-up attacks, jump on the internet. Good luck hopping over and around all of those rabbit holes.
Oh my gosh.
We're not going anywhere near them today.
Can you imagine the number of Reddit threads there are on this?
Is gabillions a word? As always, True Crime on Easy Street is the 101 version of every story we tell. So if you want to wallow around in the mud on this, give me about 20 more minutes and then you can get on the internet and knock yourself out. But you may as well stick around until the end now. Regarding the Chicago murders specifically, there was one man who claimed to be the Tylenol killer even. He wrote a letter to Johnson & Johnson demanding $1 million or he would continue the killings, the poisonings. Mm-hmm. But local and state police, working with the FBI, eventually determined that James William Lewis was his name. He lived in New York City and didn't really seem to have any actual connection to the killings. Now, that did not prevent him from being arrested, charged with extortion, mm-hmm. and convicted in December of 1983 to 30 years in prison.
As good. It should be. Yeah.
He was released in 1995 after serving 12 years. But don't forget that name. We're not finished with Richard Lewis yet. I'm sorry, James Lewis.
James.
Richard Lewis was a comedian.
Yes. Yeah. With a lot of hair.
With a lot of problems.
Oh, well, yeah.
And hair. He just died last year, I think. It turns out that James Lewis had developed he had used a postage stamp machine. There were some envelopes that were stamped with a particular Pitney Bowes machine.
Okay.
So that could be traced. Mm-hmm. He had used one of those envelopes to send the letter to Johnson & Johnson. He sent another one to the White House. And that Pitney Bowes meter was in the office of his wife's former employer. Okay. She had been fired from that job. And so, as an act of retribution, James Lewis used that envelope on purpose because the former boss of his wife's was a failing travel agent, a tax cheat, and had let his wife go without paying her last paycheck. And so, Lewis wanted to get back at this man.
All right.
That was the story he told. Mm-hmm. That discovery did not completely exonerate him. He still remained a suspect in the poisonings.
Yeah.
All right, so before the murders happened in Chicago, Tylenol had controlled more than 35% of the over-the-counter pain reliever market. 2 weeks after this happened, it's down to 8%. No surprise there, right?
No.
So the higher-ups at Johnson & Johnson had to do something. They had to do it fast. And like I said earlier, the methods they employed still taught in business schools today. Johnson & Johnson developed new product protection methods and pledged to do a better job of protecting their customers. They worked with the FDA. They introduced a new tamper-proof packaging.
Was the packaging before not tamper-proof? Like, could you just unscrew the cap?
The child-resistant bottle top had been invented in 1970, and that was it.
Okay, so like how now we have to pull the paper off and take the cotton out and all that. That wasn't there.
A foil seal on the bottle, and then the bottle itself is vacuum sealed with a little red paper that you have to tear off. And then there's a flap on the box that is now glued so that anybody can tell if the box has been tampered with in any way. Before this, that didn't happen. That was not a thing. Those packaging protections soon became the industry standard, as you might imagine. The company also introduced price reductions and a new version of their pills called the Caplet, which was still shaped like a capsule. That's what you get today almost everywhere.
Yep.
It looks like a capsule just because that's easy to swallow, and it's coated in this thin gelatin that makes it easy to swallow, and then it dissolves in your stomach and releases the medication. So no more of the little red and white plastic capsules that anybody can pull apart and put anything inside of and put it right back together.
Right.
Within a year after investing over $100 million, Tylenol sales rebounded to previous levels and the product became once again the nation's premier over-the-counter pain reliever.
How long did you say that took?
Within a year.
Within a year. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, they did some pretty admirable things and quickly made a turnaround.
Their honesty and their intense effort to reach out and to get this done made everybody maintain their trust in the company.
Absolutely.
Again, like I said, that's what they tell you to do these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
It worked for Tylenol in 82. This is what you should do. This is...
Mm-hmm. And if it worked in that scenario,
the rule book.
It should work in other scenarios.
This is, the playbook, whatever. This is the way to do it.
I mean, you have 7 people dead. Yeah. So that's... That's pretty amazing
that they were able
to maintain that trust.
The next year in 83, Congress passed the Tylenol bill, it was called, which made it a federal crime to tamper with consumer products of any kind. And by 1989, the FDA had established federal guidelines for manufacturers of OTC medications to make them tamper-proof. It's the ones we just went over, and that's the industry standard. You have to do that. Now it's the law. It's the rules.
Now they put them in these packs that you pull apart and I can't even get in them. So
no,
I can't even get in them to take them. So I'm definitely not going to be able to tamper with them.
We're telling you the reason why.
Yeah.
Okay, so now there's our unsolved murder mystery. We're not finished yet, but there's basically what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said earlier, just because the case was never solved doesn't mean there weren't any suspects. Kelly, am I boring you? You're yawning.
No, you're not boring me.
Whatever.
It's early.
I don't have my glasses on. I can't tell if your eyes are open or
closed.
It's
early on a Sunday as we record.
There was the guy who sent the ransom note that I mentioned, James William Lewis. He was the FBI's most compelling suspect. And for the 12 years he was in prison for extortion, investigators worked hard to try and convict him of the Tylenol murders before he got out on parole.
Sure.
When Lewis was arrested in New York in 82, after this nationwide manhunt, I think it was December of 82 when he was arrested finally, he did one thing that our old buddy John Douglas from the FBI, the profiler, predicted that he would do. He did several things, but here's the one I'm going to point at you.
Okay.
While he was in prison, he reached out to authorities and offered to help them with the investigation. Douglas had said, this guy is a psychopath. He is going to, at some point, reach out to somebody who was involved in the investigation and try to help.
Mm-hmm. Most of them do that.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And so at one point, Lewis gave investigators a detailed account of how, if he were the killer, he would have done it.
Okay.
In a 1992 interview with the Associated Press, Lewis told the reporter that the account he gave to the FBI was simply his way of explaining how it might have been done. What's the title of O.J. Simpson's book? If I Did It?
Mm-hmm. That is exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah.
We got two.
Uh-huh.
Two winners.
Ugh.
Lewis had a history of trouble with law. He had allegedly tried to kill his parents in 1966 when he was 19 years old. He always denied any role in the Tylenol deaths. Still, he remained a suspect. And in 2010, he gave DNA samples to the FBI. He has even created a website where he constantly defends himself against these charges. However, this troubled history with the law, among his many other faults, explains why he was considered a primary suspect.
Yeah.
Until he died in 2023 at the age of 76.
How did he die?
Natural causes.
Oh.
In 1978, he's accused of attempting to murder his parents in 66. Nothing happened there.
Okay, did he admit to that?
No,
he didn't admit to that.
Never tried, never admitted. They died under mysterious circumstances. Gotcha. And when all of these other bricks started to pile up.
How did they die?
I don't remember. Mm. I didn't go back that far, but it was some suspicious way. I don't think it was poisoning.
Did they just quickly drop dead?
I don't think it was poisoning, or it would have been mentioned more prominently since he was such a suspect in this case.
And maybe someone just didn't know to look for that when they found him dead.
Yeah. Well, in 1978, he was charged with murder in the dismemberment death of 72-year-old Raymond West.
Dismemberment?
Ooh. Yeah. Lewis had been Raymond West's accountant. And he had stolen Raymond West's identity to make credit cards for himself and spend money. So that's fraud.
Yes.
But Lewis was never sentenced. He was never even tried. The charges were dismissed because the autopsy could not determine how West had died. Mm. And because some of the evidence against Lewis had been obtained illegally. When the police searched Lewis's car, they found ropes that had the same knot in it as had been found on the body of Raymond West.
Mm.
But somebody forgot to read his Miranda rights, and the judge threw the whole thing out. Yeah, it gets worse.
Is there not a way around something like that?
Yeah, there is now. Like, that's
there
not,
is
that's
now,
not,
like that.
That's not enough.
Miranda rights, yeah, you're not going to get a whole case.
That's not enough.
Especially murder.
It may be grounds for an appeal. Right?
Dismemberment.
Well, appeals have to go with what happens in the trial.
Okay.
But, you know, because your Miranda rights are just basically saying, you know,
look,
stop talking.
Everybody knows their Miranda rights.
Yeah, everybody's seen it on television.
If you don't know them, just Google them real quick.
You could just get like any confession, any like thing that they said thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what the case was resting on.
Maybe. Okay, so they couldn't determine how the guy died. Is that because of the the dismemberment and...
Yeah, and they didn't find Raymond West's body for several months. Okay. He had been hoisted into the ceiling of a house and concealed in garbage bags.
Okay.
That's where they found his body. And a documentary that I watched over the weekend said that years later, DNA evidence determined that Lewis's thumbprint was on the hoist. But the police department crime room, evidence room, lost it.
Mm. But that was from 78. That's not uncommon.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I guess so.
And I'm not saying that people in 78 just weren't smart or they weren't careful, but it happens after several years, right?
Yeah,
I mean, when are they trying
to... This is 5 years later.
Oh, only five. Yeah. Then dang it.
Based on the documentary that I watched, the consensus among the investigators that they interviewed, Lewis got away with that one.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, two things, guys.
I think he's murdered three people so far. Yeah. Well, and has gotten away with it. His parents and this guy.
Well, we're not finished.
Okay.
That's what I was going to tell you. I'm not making this shit up.
This is like, what's that crazy Hard Rocks, let the bodies hit the floor?
Mm.
Scott is looking at, you know what I'm talking about, Katie. Is that a Rob Zombie?
Beep, 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 beep. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let the bodies, I don't know.
Not sure, somebody but I know the song, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Lewis was convicted of 6 counts of mail fraud. In a 1981 credit card scheme, like the one I described a minute ago, he would get himself hired as someone's tax accountant, and then he would use their identity to create credit card accounts for himself and spend the money.
His name's Lewis.
Yeah.
Lewis. Say that again. Say his last name.
Richard Lewis. I mean,
no.
James Lewis is our suspect.
William Lewis.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now I'm going to say Richard Lewis.
J.W. Lewis.
There you go.
If he were from Center, Alabama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's how he would be known.
Yeah. A decade after he was paroled for that extortion charge for trying to get $1 million from Johnson & Johnson, so this is 2004, Lewis was charged with rape, kidnapping, and other offenses for allegedly attacking a woman in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he had moved with his wife.
He's just a menace.
In that case, Lewis was jailed for 3 years awaiting trial. But the prosecutors dismissed the charge on the eve of the trial because the victim, refused to testify. And I have no more information there.
Oh, I hate that.
Police in 1983 had described Lewis as a chameleon who lived in several states, used at least 20 aliases, held many jobs, including computer specialist, tax accountant, importer of Indian tapestries.
That's so random.
A salesman of jewelry and pharmaceutical machinery. And real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And now we understand why James William Lewis was a suspect until the day he died.
Yes. Yeah.
After Lewis was found dead in his home in 2013, the Associated Press reached out to the nurse who had been the first person to put together the puzzle pieces about the Tylenol killings. Her name is Helen Jensen. Mm-hmm. She told the AP that she hoped Lewis's death would be the end of the tragedy, which she said had haunted her for decades, of course.
I'm sure.
And she hoped that it would bring the families of the victims some closure.
Mm-hmm.
She also told the AP that when she first figured it out and told the investigators, they laughed in her face.
That it was Tylenol?
That it was Tylenol. She said, I was a 43-year-old woman at the time and a nurse. I understood the attitudes of the day. It was 1982.
Oh, yeah.
She said, these young guys didn't know beans from apple butter, but they laughed at me, but I was only... wrong for 24 hours until it was proven right.
There you go. She must have been on her period or something, hysterical, you know.
Sir, your wife's hysterical.
When she's claiming all of these crazy things that turned out to be true.
Yeah. So there were a few obvious copycat murders later in the 80s, as I said before. And when I say obvious copycats, what I mean is that in just about all of those half dozen or so cases, it turns out that the deaths were the result of a murder plot where the wife is trying to kill the husband. Or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were other suspects in the case through the years, including a man named Roger Arnold, who, according to the bartender at the pub in his neighborhood where he lived in 1982, had become increasingly erratic after his divorce, and on more than one occasion walked into the bar, waved around a plastic bag filled with white powder, and said he was going to use it to kill people.
Was he in the Chicago area?
Yes. And he also worked alongside victim Mary Reiner's father at one point.
I think I like
she was
him
the one
better.
Who was the mother of four.
Yeah, I think
victim
I,
number six.
I like this person of interest better. Than
he was taken in by police and questioned several times, but he was never charged with anything. And here comes another twist. In 2011, the FBI even took a long, hard look at Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, who had been sentenced to life in prison in 1996 for killing three people and injuring 23 others with his mail bombs from 78 to 95. Kaczynski was considered a suspect because his first four bombings took place in the Chicago area. His parents lived in Chicago, and he had visited them in 1982. And, of course, because he was a known fucking psychopath.
Yes. Yeah.
But there was never any evidence that led him directly to the crime. According to the AP article from 2023, there are ongoing efforts with a DNA company, techno firm in Texas that are trying to run down some new leads based on technology that is brand new.
Okay.
But every time you use DNA, it's gone. Mm-hmm. So yes. There's only so much left from a case that is 43 years old.
Right.
In conclusion, we're winding it down now. Katie's already reached forward so she can hit the board as soon as possible. I think she's ready for dinner. As horrific as the Tylenol murders were, it did lead to those safety features, which have saved thousands of lives probably through the years. Now there's that tamper-resistant packaging that we talked about. So there's a good reason why the next time you can't open a bottle of Tylenol without becoming frustrated. Mm-hmm. There's a good reason for that.
Be happy about that.
Yeah, be happy it's there. On the civil front in 1991, on the eve of a massive money trial, the attorneys for Johnson & Johnson negotiated a confidential settlement with the families of the seven victims.
Sounds right.
Yeah. In a statement released at the time of the settlement, the company's lead attorney said the following. The settlement was a business proposition. At least they're telling it like it is. This was a business proposition. It is not to be inferred that Johnson & Johnson regarded its products as inferior or that it contributed to the deaths of the victims. By settling the case, the manufacturers of Tylenol do not admit responsibility.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
And I think that's very clear. I mean, they've been pretty transparent the entire time.
Yeah. So. And that's a confidential settlement.
Sure.
Nobody can say anything about how much that money was.
So we don't even know.
Yeah.
Right. How much.
And that, faithful listeners, those of you who have stuck around to the bitter end, no pun intended. We have reached the end of our story about the Chicago Tylenol.
Scott,
murders.
Who do you think did it? Which
Lewis?
Lewis
did
you do?
Yeah.
You don't think
that's
the
what
other
the investigators
guy?
Think?
Oh, okay.
No, they think
okay.
it was him.
That's what the very smart experts think,
that's right?
Right? Got it.
The people smarter than us,
like John Douglas,
the people who are doing the 200 level courses on true crime, not the things we do here.
Who literally wrote the books? It, on
probably,
them.
Probably literally the 400 level course.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. That was a really good...
that was a fun one. I had fun figuring that out.
Yeah, and that's terrifying.
Yeah.
And, you did a great job with that. Thank you very much. Say something nice about us on social media. Visit our website. What else?
Facebook page. Check us out there. We update it every week, almost every day of the week. Okay. Something true crime related. Mm-hmm. It's a way to get in touch with us and communicate if you'd like to do that.
Sure.
So
leave
out.
Us 5 stars on Apple iTunes and make a comment so that we can shout you out. But if you are listening to us, we prefer you do it on Spotify if you
pretty
can.
Please.
Yeah. You can also make comments to us on Spotify as well.
Cool. So. Is that it, guys? Are we done?
Yes.
Good night, everybody.